Welcome, folks. I'm your host, Nanette Weiser, and I am on the road today with a dear friend and colleague of mine from our early San Diego days, John M. Gliona, a Buffalo Bills fan, but even more importantly, a new book author with his third book, Rebels and Outliers. John, welcome. Can't wait to catch up on your journey.
Hey, thanks, Nanette, and hello. Good morning, everybody.
So tell us a little bit. Give us the USA Today version. Born and raised in Buffalo, ended up in San Diego, went to the LA Times, and I could read your bio, but just in a nutshell, you've been a freelance writer. You worked for the LA Times. You were their Asian LA Times foreign correspondent.
Correct.
And also their Las Vegas bureau chief. And I guess what happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas. It goes into John Gliona's books.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I think the way to sum up my career is I've sort of always been the creep or cretin that the fraternities keep in the closet during rush. You know, I'm best off out in the world, not in a newsroom. And I spent my career just out somewhere out there. And I've made a point to be places, you know, that there's no editor within sometimes a few time zones away. And that's the way that they like it, and that's the way I like it. I've just been given a long leash in my career to go out and just find stories and to find people that have stories that they haven't told before. I did it as a national correspondent for the Times, covering the West, but basically most stories west of the Mississippi or mostly west of the Rocky Mountains. I did it for a number of years in Asia, covering just a whole slew of countries where I didn't necessarily chase the news. I chased stories that I thought could tell people something about this sort of the human condition, and that's what I've been able to do. And I've been really blessed that an editor once said to someone about me, and I take this as a compliment. They said Gliona could find a story on the way to the outhouse, and I think I found many of them on trips to the outhouse. and you'll, if you buy the book, you'll say that's an outhouse story. But yeah, these people are my tribe that I write about. I find solace in the fact that there are people who, like me, don't really kind of fit into society as a whole. And this particular book, Rebels and Outliers, which kind of captures the kinds of people that I'm attracted to, is a collection of stories that I have written from the American West. I work, as you mentioned, I worked for the LA Times for 26 years in several incarnations, and there are a smattering of other stories thrown in from other publications. But this is my motley crew of storytellers, and each one is just when I look back and when I read the first few sentences and. I'm taken back to what a great experience it was to meet these people or this subculture they represent.
You know, James Rainey said this, a media reporter for LA Times. He said, it overflows with tales of dreamers, schemers, misfits, and renegades. But it's the way you tell the story, the compassion, the humor, the details. It's as you're painting, it's as you're creating a film with words. Tell us a little bit about how you embed yourself, John, in a person's life or the experience on the stories that you actually, and then you add a postscript at the end. So tell us a little bit about your process, your creative process.
Well, thank you for asking that question. I think it's readers who read stories only read what's on the written page, and they don't get the sort of backstory about how a piece came to be. I can think of a story that I did out of Albuquerque a number of years ago, a piece that's not in this collection. And I had gone to, after the Breaking Bad series ended, I went to Albuquerque to find out that if the show captured the sort of the whole culture of addiction in that community. And I ended up going to sort of a halfway house, and there were three men who had been addicted to some of the drugs that Mr. White sold over the years. And so here I am staring across the table, and, you know, how do you get people to open up to you? I didn't do this as a device, but I told them a story about my addicted sister and how I had dealt with addiction as a family member, and how, you know, I still loved her and cared for her, and then we just started having a conversation, and that's what it is. I think it's having a conversation with people that you are interviewing, and giving a little bit of yourself in interviews, as much as you want to get. I've taught journalism classes, and I always young reporters don't realize that they are in a power position, in a sense, when you're doing an interview, unless you're doing some, you know, you're interviewing somebody famous who kind of seen reporters as sort of something to be endured. Most people have not been interviewed many times in their lives, and the person sitting there they look up to them as sort of a sort of respect, and so you want to use that to sort of, you know, and to sort of get them. You're a professional. You know what you want. They don't know what the process is. But the way to go is not, as I've told young students, is not to go with like a questionnaire, you know, question number one, question number two. Have a conversation with someone, and in that it'll come out. I always just sort of pretend I'm having beers with somebody at a bar and, you know, ordering rounds as we go. And in the end, the story comes out.
You know, I was just rereading John McPhee, and he said in one of his older pieces that you should not see yourself in the story. And this is so, I know that, but yet you're not the omniscient observer either. How do you paint that picture? I mean, how many, you know, when you're there and you're traveling, like, for example, you were just doing a piece on a woman in Africa in your blog that I thought was fascinating. So, and then last summer you spent time in Italy and started writing about that. So how do you decide? Do you decide before you get there, this is what I'm going to write about, or do you just let it kind of unfold, because you have an incredible eye, like a scientist, that doesn't forget one detail? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I, as a reporter, when I was operating on Deadline, I would be sort of a done in a day story, and mm-hmm. I would leave an interview, and I didn't have a lot of time to let it, as a joke with a friend of mine, you know, cake. It didn't get much time in the oven, and I would on the way back to the newsroom. I never listened to the radio. I would let all the information kind of free fall in my mind, and to think of what they said and what was the moment of the interview where they sort of gave of themselves, and it was a very, as you mentioned, which is very perceptive, a cinematic moment of the interview, and that's usually what I went with. And having more time to, you know, I've written traditional nonfiction books, and having more time to sort of plot them and know where they are, you develop a scene, and you show what a place is like and what a person is like, and you kind of go from there. I have a book that's not published yet. I'm looking for a publisher on Southern Italy, the town my grandfather was born in, and I begin the book in the main piazza of the place where I spent most of two summers at dawn in the summertime, and exactly what happens there, all the way from the birds in the belfry to the fruit sellers waking up in the morning. And so, you know, that it's a jumping off spot. And I think for listeners to your program, we've all gone to bookstores just perusing it, whether they're, you know, the new stuff or the used bookshelves. And I always sort of like pick up a book and I will read the first paragraph, the first line. I'd like to do this with friends, because I think a lot of, you put a lot of work into that first line. It's haiku. It's and sometimes a writer might choose to write to do a scene. So you can't just read the first line of a scene. You have to read the whole scene, and that's where it is a welcome mat to the to the reader, saying, "This is a little bit of what you're going to find in this story, and I'm choosing to begin here, and hopefully you'll see why."
Well, Dickens, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, and
There you
honestly,
go.
I love that. I love that the first line is a haiku. Folks, if you're whether you're going to be a writer or you're just looking for a good book, please note, folks, if you've just joined me today, I am talking to John Gliona. He is a journalist and author. His newest book, Rebels and Outliers, Real Stories from the America West, is out, and we're very excited to be visiting with him. He divides his time, San Francisco, Las Vegas, and where else? The world is kind of your welcome mat, isn't it?
La La Land. I used to. I can't give up, trips there. But for now, I'm in San Francisco, and I lived in Las Vegas for 10 years. Many of them working for the LA Times. And when I left the Times in 2015, I wasn't really ready to come back to San Francisco. My wife lives here. We live together now. Finally, in COVID, we reunited. But she has her career and her job, and I felt that I had lived in California and written about California, but Nevada beckoned because there were stories out there. Nevada is just it's a strange state, and some of my Nevada stories are in this book. But there was a book that I'd written a couple of years ago, a collection of stories called Outback Nevada, and that in between Reno and Las Vegas, or all these different communities and places where people live, and I would love to just do road trips to find them. So I but for now I'm kind of looking east because I have a new book in mind in from China, and and my wife and I are considering moving to China in the next few years.
And we're talking not Taiwan, we're talking
We're
China.
talking, we are, we're talking mainland China. Being based in Beijing. The idea of the book, and I don't, I it's, I'd love to hear from readers, who respond to the programs, is that China has built more highways in the last 15 years than America has done in its whole history. And China is immense. And China, there's outback China, if you want to use that paradigm. My idea would be to get in a car and drive the circumference of China with my wife as the sort of the native and the native interpreter, and me sort of the Chinese know us in a sense in a joking manner. I refer to myself as a baigui or white devil. That's what Mao referred to the West. We're all white devils, and we're trying to take over China. So I'm the white devil and the native interpreter, driving around not highways but blue highways all around China, from Tibet to Xinjiang, to and write about my our experiences as we go. My wife is she's on the ledge about this story because she thinks I will get us killed, but I think I
Oh,
can
just a small price to pay for being the Larry McMurtry of China, right? Because I remember Larry would crisscross the country looking for pie and write about it in the Times. So you're going to do a Larry McMurtry, and oh my God, John, fabulous.
Thank you so
Publishers, if you're
much.
listening, jump on this now. Well, I want to, before we launch into some of the people we meet in Rebels and Outliers, I want to mention your previous book, No Friday Night Lights, which was Reservation Football on the Edge of America. Folks, this is really should be a TV series. But John, tell us a little bit about that book and how that came about before we jump into Rebels and Outliers.
The book was about, this was from my Nevada days, and I had written a story about a very small football team out in the ether. They were in such an isolated community. They played 8-man football. They didn't have enough kids to play the traditional 11-man. My idea in finding the team was I wanted to write about a football team as a way to get at isolation in the West. And this is a theme of Rebels and Outliers. But there are there. This was a community right on the border of Oregon and Nevada. In fact, the state line ran right through the middle of town, where there are no services. There's two gas stations, a casino, everybody to get any kind of things, to go to the doctor, to go to the dentist, to go to the Walmart, you had to drive 71 miles down the Winnemucca. And these towns are fast disappearing in the West. And I wanted to write about what it was like to live there, who lived there, through the sort of the device of the football team. And this team, as it were, was one that that never won. They rarely won, but the kids kept showing up, and it was the battle of the coaches to keep them inspired to keep showing up. And in the end, the book, the people who have read it, and I've spent time talking about it on podcasts, it's really not about football. It's about the characters in the town. And again, I'm always drawn to characters. So that's what it's about.
Well, you've made a career out of zagging while others zigged and telling the stories and creating a word album filled with snapshots of humanity. I'm going to cite Anne O'Neill, who also worked with you at the LA Times. I think that's beautifully said. You've been compared to Calvin Trillin and Tom Wolfe, and Hunter Thompson, but who, in your mind, has inspired you as an author and sort of helped you craft your incredible craft?
Well, writers read and writers have to read, and I have always thought that compare the two processes is reading is breathing in and writing is breathing out, and I'm lucky that I have that opportunity to we're all readers, but sometimes if you're not a writer, then sometimes you read and you're influenced by stuff. But I get a chance to sort of play out what I've learned from other writers, there's not any particular writer that I would say that I. You mentioned John McPhee, and who's a big fan of him, Brandon Carver, and I think they are. I think I sort of tend to like to write this simple sentence. There's a Western writer by the name of Rick Bass who has written a lot about Montana, and he began his life in his first book as he was an oil. I worked in the oil industry, and his first book was called Oil Notes. And it's a spare title. And the first line in Rick's first book was, "I know how to find oil." And I loved it. And I that might have not been draw all your readers in or all your listeners in, but I was hooked. And that's the kind of simple, the simple writing. Hemingway, if you would say, telling the tale. And I remember when I was in college, I wrote a piece, in the vein of the new journalism with Tom Wolfe, where writers put themselves in the stories. And I was a college student in Buffalo, New York, and I wanted to find what I call the archetypal gas station attendant. I wanted to find the guy who pumped gas for a living, and he wasn't doing it because he was a college student, but that's what he did. He worked in and at the time there were, this was during the 1970s. And I wrote about my quest to find this guy, and then when I finally found him, I spent some time with him and what his view of the world was. And I remember describing the inside of the gas station office if you go in to pay. And I remember the editor was saying, basically, it's like, you got too much clutter in here. Find the telling detail and what readers are going to remember about that. And I always remember that you can't describe everything. You find that detail which says something the most about the person that you're writing about. So that's sort of my I'm always picking up new voices to read, because they do influence. The reading that you're doing now influences the writing you're going to do tomorrow.
And absolutely, because as I read this, folks, let's just take a little journey now with Rebels and Outliers, and I'm just going to quote a little bit from Steve Padilla, who is your editor. We're introduced to a crossdresser, a former cowboy in Wyoming, a guy who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and lived, a convicted rapist who returned to his remote mountain hometown in Santa James, one of my favorite stories, a homeless man who dressed as Santa. And then, of course, the inspiring, indomitable Dolores Westfall, who you said, John, was too poor to retire and too young to die, who traveled as a nomad. So with no further ado, John, talk to us a little bit about some of the people that we meet in the country, wildland, wild places, and heartbreak out there.
Well, you've given it a good start, Nanette. I mean, the first story in the book is about a Navajo police officer woman whose beat is basically the size of Delaware, and who she's a Navajo officer, she's a Navajo woman working for the Navajo Police Department, and the idea of just the vast amount of space and that she has to cover as a single officer, knowing that backup is hours away if she ever gets into any trouble. And it's sort of it really is a story, you know, about isolation. And I thought it was a good, in fact, on the cover of the book, there is, the cover is a very beautiful shot of Shiprock, which is this lonely outpost of a sort of a jagged uprising in the desert in New Mexico, that is sacred to the Navajo. And so there's that, and so that was the I divide up the book in the country, wildland, wild places, people who have suffered heartbreak, the wildland, wild places. One of the stories is about, and you know, I wanted to go up. My father was living in Alaska, and was just so happy to be part of my coverage area for the LA Times. And so I went up and did a piece about, and a bush pilot who, you know, they're sort of the taxi drivers for the Uber drivers of in parts of Alaska where there aren't roads. And my main character was a great guy, and he took me up on several flights, and we flew it. I remember one of the jokes he always made that when he came back to the airport in Ketchikan, he would always fly over his house to see if his wife was entertaining anybody while he was gone. And it's probably one of the most dangerous jobs in America. And as you mentioned, I do postscripts on all of the interviews if I could find out, like, well, whatever happened to that person. And as it turns out, he crashed and died when doing a tour. My pilot, the pilot that I interviewed, one of the pieces that I did was a first person story of my father was in his 80s, and he was living with a sister of mine who moved him from near Miami up or from the Bahamas, actually. They'd lived in Miami previously, from the Bahamas up to Ketchikan, Alaska. And my father didn't want to make him fly the whole way, so we rented a huge RV camper with three of his kids and my dad and two dogs, and we drove across country, and we all thought it would be this great cigarette commercial, smiling and stories told, but it ended up being a nightmare with the kids fighting and my father sort of breaking up fights like he had when he was young. And so I described it as like having a Thanksgiving dinner with your worst racist uncle traveling along at 80 miles an hour. And it happened out west in most of the book, or most of the story. As you mentioned, I wrote about a man in the out west section, about a guy who was a cross-dresser in Wyoming, and all the Sissy Goodwin is his name, and he was a teacher at a local college. Sissy was a man's man, and he liked to drink beer, he did rodeo, but he happened to like to dress in women's clothing, and he took that penchant that he, after years of therapy, and you know, his wife, you know, knew what he liked to do. He did it in public. He would wear, you know, little pink outfits to teaching, and this is in Wyoming, and you can imagine this. You know, this is a story, the place where Matthew Shepard was killed, you know, for being gay, and Sissy was beaten, and but Sissy continued to be Sissy no matter where he was. So I'm just looking through the you know, the you mentioned the pig farmer. Nanette, before the interview started, and there was a guy, again, you know, I'm living in Vegas at the time, and when I read about somebody, I say, I want to go meet that guy. And he was he had a farm outside of Las Vegas, and he it was sort of, I called during the story, it was sort of the way the you could take, you know, the whole system of recycling food. His workers would go to the casinos every morning and pick up all the stuff that they threw out from all of the sort of all-you-can-eat buffets. He would take him out to his farm. He would feed it to his pigs. He would raise his pigs. And in the end, he would sell his pigs back to the casino. And he was, and it was just this wonderful sort of recycling Vegas style story. And he was a character, and he loved his pigs. You know, I mean, if you put them, they're all different people. They all come from different parts of the West, but they all have that something in connection that they just stand out.
They're pioneers, great, resilient, yeah. Pioneering space. So one of my favorites, and I think the one that got you your first column one story that you're going to read a little bit for us is about the Mojave phone booth.
Yes, the Mojave Desert phone booth, and I'm trying to find out where this is. Here we go, heartbreak out there out west. Let me see. I should have had it.
Well, while John is finding that, I just want to mention he also has optioned the film rights to some of his stories. He's written a screenplay for John Peters based on an LA Times story that delved into the subculture of drag queens in LA, and two more film projects, A Sad and Sweet Life of a Jewish Baker Who Cooked for the Nazis During World War II, and another on tent boxing and the Australian Outback. And folks, I encourage you to go to John's website. We'll have that link in our article for this online on-air magazine interview. And you do want to get his blogs, because I didn't even know there was such a thing as tent boxing in Australia. And also, I just loved your newest piece on Idaho. So, John, will you share with us now the Mojave phone booth, a little bit of a taste of John Gliona?
Sure. I will set this reading up. It's not long. It's just the beginning of the story. Again, I try to put the reader at the phone booth. This was in the Mojave Desert between Las Vegas and L.A. If you've ever driven it, through the desert on the 10 on the 15 rather, years ago, there was a cement factory out in the middle of nowhere, and this is in the 1960s, and Ma Bell built a phone booth when there was a road there where the truckers would stop and say, I'm leaving, the, you know, I'm on my way or whatever. And so it was regularly used, and it was a paved road. Well, the concrete factory closed, and the road rolled up and died. And when I wrote the story, I think it was 1995, it was really back to desert. And the only thing that remained from those old days was the phone booth, which is still there. It was the kind of phone booth where you would open it up with the accordion door, and you could step in and close the door and talk. But it was out there, and it still worked. So I read about it online that there was a hiker who was out, and he went out and he was hiking once, and he thought he saw a mirage because he looked up and there was no trail. He was like probably 15 miles from the nearest paved road, and there's this phone booth out in the middle of nowhere. And he picked it up, and there was dial tone, and he wrote a blog post about it, and it became popular. And so what happened is that people started calling this phone booth from all over the world, and they had all kinds of reasons for doing it. And it was sort of this modern world of, you know, the internet and cell phones. And, you know, in 1995, the internet was just getting started. We all had cell phones at the time. And, you know, this phone booth became a connection between the past and the present. And I pitched the story to an editor, and it ran in this space that was it was prized. Once every day they would run on the front page a particular story that stood out for its writing or its subject matter, and it was very competitive at the LA Times. And you'd write a story, and your editor would present it to this other editor that sort of governed this space, which was called Column One. And, you know, you'd have to read it, and there'd be all this sort of like, well, is he going to take it? My editor walked in to Roger Smith's office. Roger was the editor, and told Roger that Gliona had a story about a phone booth in the middle of the desert, and Roger's response was sold. So this story was accepted as a column one before I even wrote it. So now I was up to say, well, I better live up to the expectations. So here's the beginning of the story. Mojave National Preserve, California. With only the lazy Joshua trees and hovering buzzards out here to bear witness, this isolated expanse of high desert plain could well be among the quietest places on the planet. By day, the summer heat hammers hard, and the dull whistle of the wind is the only discernible noise. Come nightfall, the eerie silence is often pierced by the woeful bleat of a wandering burro. But wait, there's another sound. Ring. Along a line of wooden power poles running to the horizon in both directions, 14 miles from the nearest paved road, a solitary payphone beckons with a shrill sound of impatient civilization. Then it rings again and again and yet again, often dozens of times a day. The callers, a bored housewife from New Zealand, a German high school student, an on-the-job Seattle stockbroker, a long-distance trucker who dials in from the road. There's a proud skunk owner from Atlanta, a pizza delivery man from San Bernardino, California, and a bill collector from Denver given a bum steer while tracing a debt. Receivers in hand, they're reaching out at all hours of the day and night from nearly every continent on the globe to make contact with this forlorn desert outpost. They're calling the Mojave Desert phone booth.
Wow. You know, I'm going to tell you this, Superman, it's just very appropriate that we are reading this piece as Superman once again is hitting the sky. So, folks, we've been talking with John Gliona, Rebels and Outliers, Real Stories from the America West. We hope that perhaps he will visit another Rebel and Outlier state, Florida, to sign his book and talk about his book, putting it out there, Book and Bottle, Tombolo Books, and Oxford Exchange. John, before we sign off today, and I hope we get to talk to you again on Radio St. Pete, please share with us why your posse has real meaning in a world that seems to be scripted by influencers.
Well, yeah, this is sort of like why I like Nevada. You know, I prefer Nevada to California because in California, everybody has a PR agent, and you know, in Nevada, people did they didn't they were still what they were, and are you know, in my generation, you know, I'm born in the 50s, and you know, I sort of sit back and look with amazement and at the control of the media and the American story that are being, you know, given to us by influencers. And if you know, kind of peel through that and look, there are other people out there that aren't as in your face, and they're out there, and they have a story to tell. And I've always found it is my sort of, you know, sort of duty to go out and find those people and bring their stories to just hopefully to either a magazine or perhaps a podcast that they have just so much more to say than that. You know, they're the real influencers in my book.
Well, you know, John, it's been wonderful to be on the road with you. And folks, if you want to know more about John, you can go to his website, www.johngliona.com. Follow him on Facebook. I've just enjoyed a number of his pieces. And actually, my favorite might be this week, John. I'm crowing for crows, thanks to you.
Thank you, Nanette.
For Radio St. Pete, I'm your host, Nanette Weiser. John, thank you so much for sharing your story. Rebels and Outliers out there, join John and I back again in studio for another talk soon.